The Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but... Okay, you know that Israel's talked a lot about in the Bible, but why should we support Israel today? Does this have anything to do with that ancient country? After all, didn't the Jews just come from Europe and steal that land from the Palestinians? No, my friends, they did not. Nothing even close to that happened. We today are in the middle of a series. This is the third in a series about Israel. If you missed the first two, they are on my website. And I'm just going to continue right from where I left off. Prior to the first major wave of Jewish immigration in 1882, only 250,000 Arabs lived in the area, and the majority of them were fairly new arrivals themselves. From 1900 to 1914, some 40,000 enthusiastic Jewish immigrants flooded into Palestine. Between the First and Second World War, the Jewish population increased by 350,000, and the mostly Arab non-Jewish population increased by 380,000. After the partition vote that we talked about last week from the United Nations, Israel declared its independence on May 14, 1948. One day later, five Arab armies invaded Israel from Egypt, Transjordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. Jews pleaded with Palestinian Arabs to remain in their homes. Although many of the Arabs did flee or join the invading armies, a considerable portion of Arabs remained in Israel. This interesting fact is seldom discussed. More than 300,000 Arabs fled Israel around that time, and about 160,000 remain. Today, Israel contains a vital Arab population. Everybody thinks the word Israeli and Jew means the same thing. There are Arabs who are Israeli citizens, and these Arabs have more rights in Israel than any other Arab in any Arab country. In fact, shortly before Yasser Arafat's death, when there was talk once again under the Bush administration of a separate Palestinian state, the Arab citizens in Israel were asked if they wanted to move, renounce their Israeli citizenship, and live in the Palestine sector. Guess what they decided? Some of them probably fell on the floor laughing before saying to the Israeli government, "Oh, I'm sorry, you were serious." In 1948, when Israel beat the odds and defeated multiple invading nations, the problem of refugees came up. Now, we always hear about the Arab refugees from Israel, but they were not the only refugees from this war. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were kicked out of Arab lands, too. All of the Jewish refugees were welcomed into Israel, whereas Arabs who wanted to resettle in Arab countries were, for the most part, denied admission. Jordan was an exception, but even in Jordan, most of the refugees were confined to camps. They lived in that condition all the way up to 1967, when Israel annexed Jordan's West Bank. Prior to 1967, there was no significant ongoing discussion amongst the countries of the world demanding Jordan's treatment of the poor Palestinians cease. On December 11th, 1948, the United Nations drafted and ratified Resolution 194. This was a call for the Arab states and Israel to resolve the refugee settlement issues, but the condition was that all returning citizens would agree to live in peace. Receiving no such guarantee from the Arabs, Israel decided to postpone repatriation until her neighbors would recognize her right to exist. Although, as a general rule, the Arab refugees left Israel on their own, there are always exceptions to the rule during times of war. And there were a few, extremely few cases of Arabs being forced out of their homes by the Israelis. Some of this is understandable, since most Arabs were siding with five nations that vowed to annihilate every last Jew. One such case is the forced evacuation of the village of Biram. But even in this situation, the Arabs relocated to a nearby village, and they did remain in the country of Israel, where they reside to this day. Recently, the Israeli government has taken a more sympathetic interest to their complaint, and a positive solution may still be in the horizon. But such rare occurrences must not cause us to ignore the fact that most of the Arabs who chose to remain in Israel were never forced to leave. They became citizens with full rights and privileges. Nevertheless, the world was about to be deceived by the most brilliant, most sinister, most destructive historical revision to ever surface on our planet. Realizing that they were unable to win a real war against Israel, the Arabs waged the war of public opinion instead. The pawns, Arab refugees, soon to be renamed Palestinian refugees, and the leader of their cause would be a man who was not even born in Palestine. True or false, Israel is illegally occupying many Arab lands today. Three guesses are allowed. You got it. False. In fact, you've probably guessed by now over these last couple of weeks that all of the answers on our modest little true-false test are false. But what the heck? We started with that format. We'll continue with it. In 1967, several decades after the rebirth of Israel, nine different nations, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Algeria, Kuwait, Sudan, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq, declared war on Israel and promised to exterminate every Jew. This was a message that broadcast on Radio Cairo, May 17, 1967. Egypt is ready to plunge you into a total war that will mean the end of Israel. Well, surprising the world with a preemptive strike, Israel defeated the Arabs in just 6 days. At that time, their territory was expanded to the West Bank, the Golan Heights, the Gaza Strip, and the Sinai. They also took the remainder of Jerusalem, half of which had been under Jordanian control after the War of Independence. This territory is frequently referred to as part of Israel's illegal occupation. Now, I tend to hate that term, and I argue against it for the following reasons. First of all, when we think of occupying countries, what usually comes to mind is an aggressive empire seeking to conquer and expand, not a tiny little nation that enlarged its borders only as a means of survival to prevent her untrustworthy neighbors from attacking again. Two, most of this land had been legally offered to Israel in the Balfour Declaration anyway that we talked about last week before Great Britain sold it behind Israel's back. Three, historically, the land had been the home of the Jews for literally thousands of years. Four, the United Nations has become so corrupt that I no longer accept their standard as to what is legal or illegal. During the Six-Day War, when the Israelis were under the command of Defense Minister Moshe Dayan, this guy that captured the remainder of Jerusalem, a decision was made unparalleled by any nation in the history of warfare. Under the original UN Patriation Plan, Jerusalem was going to be under international authority. When the surrounding nations turned down the plan and attacked Israel, new borders rose out of the debris, with Israel owning the western section of Jerusalem and Jordan controlling East Jerusalem. Jordan's territory included the old holy city and the Temple Mount, where the Muslim Dome of the Rock stood on land that had once hosted the Jewish temple. From 1948 to 1967, Jews were not allowed to worship at the Temple Mount. But Jordan cited as its reason the refusal to allow Palestinian refugees to resettle in Israel. Now all was about to change. The Israelis were in control of the entire city, East and West Jerusalem combined. While they could have bulldozed the Dome of the Rock, leaving the ground ripe for building the third Jewish temple, Dayan instead decided to leave this Islamic shrine for the Arab Muslims still living in Jerusalem. Not only that, but Jews were forbidden to pray there. Forbidden by the Israeli government! This decision struck much controversy in Israel, especially from the religious community. After all, shortly before Dayan's unusual decision, Israelis had heard the words of the parachute commander shouting victoriously over his field radio, "The Temple Mount is in our hands." Well, the euphoria was short-lived. Diane explained his decision. This was his explanation. "We have returned to the holiest of our places, never to be parted from them again. We did not come to conquer the sacred sites of others or to restrict their religious rites, but rather to ensure the integrity of the city and to live in it with others in fraternity." Now, ladies and gentlemen, compare this to the way the Palestinians of Gaza responded after Israel gave back the Gaza Strip as a peace treaty in 2005. Every Jewish synagogue was immediately burned down and missiles were promptly fired over the border at Israel. Compare also with Palestinian desecration of sacred Jewish shrines following peace treaties where Israel yielded control back to the Palestinian Authority. Shrines such as Joseph's tomb, it was set on fire and defiled. Or shrines such as Rachel's tomb, it was turned into a fort of concrete complete with firing holes. True or false, the PLO was created only to take back what Israel stole, not to annihilate Israel. False. First of all, the PLO was created not by a Palestinian, but by Egyptian President Nasser, who shamelessly admitted that its goal was the liquidation of Israel. The PLO was founded in 1964. Israel's so-called occupation followed the Six-Day War in 1967. You can do the math, can't you? Of course, the most well-known name in association with the PLO is Yasser Arafat. He was not a Palestinian either. Arafat was born in Cairo, Egypt, 1929. And he was related to the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, friend of Adolf Hitler, a Nazi operator in World War II. Concerning the Jews, Arafat said, "Surely the judgment of Allah is reserved for them until Palestine is transformed from the house of war to the house of Islam." Arafat and his friends basically created modern-day terrorism as we know it. In 1951, Arafat joined the Muslim Brotherhood, which later assassinated Anwar Sadat for signing a peace treaty with Israel. In 1957, after the Muslim Brotherhood was outlawed, Arafat fled Egypt and made his way to Kuwait in order to avoid arrest.
Believe it or not, Bob Siegel is aware that there may be one or two people who disagree with his opinions. To offer your own comments on the topic at hand or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, feel free to contact Bob on Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome back to 1170 The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. We're in the middle of a series about Israel, and I've been teasing you for the last couple of weeks, telling you that my book about Israel was coming out any day, and it kept getting postponed, and it kept getting postponed. But as of this afternoon, the book is published. It's available on Amazon.com. You could order a print copy right now. You can get a Kindle version in just a couple of days. It's called The Holocaust Against Israel. Anyway, continuing from where we left off before the break, I was mentioning that in 1957, after the Muslim Brotherhood was outlawed, Yasser Arafat fled Egypt and made his way to Kuwait in order to avoid arrest. In 1969, Yasser Arafat became chairman of the PLO, Fatah, and other PLO splinter groups that commanded hundreds of attacks around the world. Now, before I describe his exploits in detail, which I'm about to do, let me give a warning. If you have a weak stomach, you may want to turn the radio off. But I hope you'll be strong enough to listen because, frankly, it's important and you should hear this, but I want you to be able to make that choice for yourself. The PLO was chased out of Jordan in 1970, from Lebanon in 1982, and from Syria in 1985. During this turbulent period, they murdered literally tens of thousands of people. Journalists Evans and Novak will never be accused of having a love affair with Israel. Nevertheless, after visiting Beirut and other areas of Lebanon, they reported that facts, in their words, tend to support Israel's claim that the PLO has become permeated by thugs and adventurers. They also interviewed a Lebanese doctor whose farm had been seized by the PLO and transformed into a military outpost. According to this report, the PLO would invade the apartment complexes, removing the inhabitants to make room for the storage of ammunition and explosives. Fathers were shot in front of their own families. This was followed by consistent rape of innocent females carried on shamelessly without the slightest bit of hesitation. 100,000 such rapes are estimated, but it may have been as many as 300,000. Lebanese surgeon Dr. Torbi said, and I'm quoting him, "I treated men whose testicles had been cut off in torture sessions. I saw like men dragged through the streets by fast-moving cars to which they were tied by their feet. I know of cases of people being thrown into acid tanks and reduced to unrecognizable masses of porous bone. Many young girls came to me for abortions after being raped by PLO gangsters." Professor Augustus H. Strong shares a tale every bit as harrowing. He says, "The PLO killed Susan's father and brother and raped her mother, who suffered a hemorrhage and died. They raped Susan many times, cut off her breasts and shot her. She was later found without her four limbs, so battered that she had to be amputated. Now she had only the upper part of one arm." Now, some would argue that Yasser Arafat shares a degree of responsibility if murders and rapes took place by individuals who were ultimately under his command. The United Nations, gotta love the United Nations, they didn't see it that way. They awarded Yasser Arafat the Nobel Peace Prize. Well, after all, he shook hands once with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. In fact, Arafat managed to build quite a reputation for himself as a lover of peace. He has, you'll be glad to know, officially denounced terrorism many times. Here's one time where he did it publicly. "I, as chairman of Palestine Liberation Organization, hereby once more declare that I condemn terrorism in all its forms." Oh, that sounds great so far. Unfortunately, he went on in that very same speech to say, "I also offer a reverent salute to the martyrs who have fallen at the hand of terrorism and terrorists, foremost among whom is my lifelong companion and deputy, the martyr symbol, Khali al-Wazar." Now, FYI, Khali al-Wazar, otherwise known as Abu Jihad, planned and directed some of the worst massacres of Israeli citizens. Get it? You catching on, folks? Terrorism was defined by Arafat as what Israel had done to the PLO, not what the PLO had done to Israel. Not that he was always that subtle. Oftentimes it depended on who was in the audience. Arab diplomats were treated to Arafat's honest intentions during a speech at the Grand Hotel in Stockholm, Sweden, January 30th, 1996. The speech went somewhat like this. I'll read you a portion. "The PLO will now concentrate on splitting Israel psychologically into two camps. We plan to eliminate the state of Israel and establish a Palestinian state. We will make life unbearable for Jews by psychological warfare and population explosion. Jews will not want to live among Arabs. I have no use for Jews. They are and remain Jews. We now need all the help we can get from you in our battle for a united Palestine under Arab rule. Now, some will deny that Arafat made that speech, claiming, as usual, that the news report, being Jewish, could not be trusted. However, other news entities outside of Israel have offered additional verification, including the British quarterly publication BIPAC and the Norwegian newspaper Dagen. Perhaps this next gem from Arafat sums it up best. Peace for us means the destruction of Israel. You catching that, ladies and gentlemen? Let me read to you again from the man who received the Nobel Peace Prize, Yasser Arafat. Peace for us means the destruction of Israel. We are preparing for an all-out war, a war which will last for generations. We shall not rest until the day when we return to our home and until we destroy Israel. That was in 1980 when he gave that speech. One of today's tired, politically correct talking points says, well, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. How clever. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, I get men like George Washington confused with Yasser Arafat all the time. Unfortunately, these mindless sayings are quite effective if repeated often enough. True or false, Arab nations which express hostility toward the United States do so only because of America's support of Israel. Answer, false. You have only to listen to the words of a typical Middle East chant to understand that after Israel's out of the way, America would be next. Here's one. It says, first we will fight the Saturday people, then we will fight the Sunday people. Saturday people refers to the Jews, with Saturday being an obvious reference to the Jewish Sabbath. Sunday, of course, points to the Christian community, the day they attend church commemorating the resurrection of Jesus. While popular practices in Muslim countries by no means speak for every one of their citizens, today's tremendous anti-American sentiment in the Middle East cannot be denied. All too often, it is assumed that America's reputation is stapled to her support of Israel. It's high time that we wake up and face a sobering truth. Jihadists do not hate America because of Israel. Indeed, they hate us for the same reason they hate Israel. And this reason, if you'll pardon me for speaking a painful truth, is a religious one. We'll be right back. This is Bob Siegel. With the wiring in your home, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. For all you know, he may have gotten his license by sending in 3 serial box tops.
Hey, these things happen. There's nothing wrong with my wiring. Houses burned down. If you wanted a guarantee, you should have ordered the deluxe package.
Folks, play it smart. Call WNS Electric Incorporated. They specialize in contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, WNS takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I use them myself, and I wouldn't call anyone else. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for WNS Electric, license number 480539. WNS Electric.
Is it really true that there will be peace in the Middle East if we just have a two-state solution? Or are some people instead challenging Israel's right to exist at all? Is it true that Jews have no historical claim to the Holy Land and stole that land from a people called the Palestinians? Bob Siegel's latest book challenges the historical revision of the Israeli-Palestinian situation and shows how Israel's struggle may soon be the struggle of the entire world. The Holocaust Against Israel by Bob Siegel, Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
From Ramon Bennett, an English-born Christian whose love for Israel inspired him to move there and become a citizen. Bennett's concern was that other countries understand that the battle being fought by Israel would someday become their battle, too. And we're going to spend a lot of the rest of the program talking about how Israel's battle is our battle, too. Take a look at this chillingly prophetic word that Ramon Bennett wrote in the early 1990s. This was long before 9/11, folks. This brave writer tried in vain to warn a sleeping Western civilization about fundamentalist Islam, which is today more commonly called radical Islam. He says, "I have expressed for a number of years my belief that Islam is the Western world's most potentially dangerous enemy. Long before the collapse of the Soviet Union and its communist ideology, I had said that communism did not nearly equal Islam's threat to the West. I have repeatedly warned of what lies ahead unless definite steps are taken to curb the increasing momentum of a fundamentalist Islam, but my warnings have thus far fallen upon deaf ears." Well, you're now prepared, over-prepared, for the next statement of falsehood. This one is perhaps the most misunderstood of all. True or false, the Quran is a peaceful book, and its author, Muhammad, was a peaceful man. False. Yes, I know those are very controversial words. Now, I'm not going to give a huge explanation, and I'll tell you why. A few months ago, I did an entire radio program on Islam. You can listen to it off of my website. The date was February 26, 2017. The title was Islam, Peaceful, Violent, or Both? And I'll put a link to it on this week's show, too. In the programming notes for this week and for other weeks, I do put in broadcast. I'll put in links to our previous shows regarding this series. I'll put in a link to this thing about Islam. Now, I do still have a lot to say about Islam right now, quite a bit to say, as a matter of fact, but I'm not going to be repeating the same points I made in that previous program, at least not in much detail. Instead, for the moment, just to provide some context, let me quickly review the points I made in that program. First of all, the Quran really does command jihad. I don't care what you've heard. I've read it. It does command jihad. Such verses are not being taken out of context. The true context to any literature is found by asking the question, what did the original author intend to say? And what did his original audience understand him to mean? Muhammad not only commanded war, he waged it. That is how he conquered the Arabian Peninsula. Now, there are Muslims who are unfamiliar with their own holy book. They deny any commands to wage jihad, and they do so sincerely. There are other Muslims who are aware of the violent verses and make a conscious choice to reinterpret them. In that program I'm referring to, I spent a lot of time talking about one such Muslim spokesman. He does this publicly, Dr. Zudi Jasser. But there's also a third type. While some Muslims are sincere when they say they have no intention of conquering the world, others who say the exact same thing do so insincerely. Why? Because Muslims are taught that it is okay to lie during a time of war. A passionate Muslim admitted as much to me once in the midst of a serious discussion. In fact, we had the discussion years ago right on this radio program. While denying that Muslims are permitted to lie in general, he went on to explain that during times of war, lies are often necessary, and as much as anyone waging war will be less than factual with the enemy. At this time, I voiced a rather obvious question. When are Muslims not at war? He responded with a vague, unsatisfactory answer, but here are the words of a man who was not so vague, Muhammad himself. Muhammad said, "Lying is wrong, except in three things. The lie of a man to his wife to make her content with him, a lie to an enemy for war is deception, or a lie to settle trouble between people." Now, of course, it's not always easy to figure out when a person is lying, and nobody can read minds, but we can read polls. You would be surprised to learn how many Muslims around the world, while perhaps denouncing hardcore terrorism, still openly accept ideas associated with Islamic violence, dominance, and Sharia law. 80% of Muslim women view wife beating as a normal state of affairs, according to the Jerusalem Post. Now, before you rush in and call that Jewish propaganda, since the poll was taken by the Jerusalem Post, consider an older source for the same kind of thought. Men are in charge of women because Allah hath made the one of them to excel the other, and because they spend of their property for the support of women. So good women are the obedient, guarding a secret, that which Allah hath guarded. As for those from whom ye fear rebellion, admonish them and banish them to beds apart and scourge them. Then if they do obey you, seek not a way against them. Lo, Allah is ever exalted. That was from the Quran, ladies and gentlemen. Looking beyond the Quran, we see little indication that modern times have curtailed such thinking. 2/3 of Muslims around the world express belief in Sharia law. 91% of Jordanian college students, express acceptance of wife beating. 6 majority Muslim nations polled have a derogatory opinion of Jews. That's Turkey, Pakistan, Indonesia, Morocco, Lebanon, and Jordan. The other nations don't have that high of opinion of the Jews either. These are just the ones in this survey. 61% of Muslims around the world express serious doubt that 9/11 was carried out by Arabs. Many of them claim it was done by the Jews. Jewish conspiracy. 40% of Indonesians endorse violence against any who would blaspheme Islam. 62% of British Muslims in the same survey said there should be no freedom of speech. Get this? No freedom of speech if it insults Muslims. And 78% of British Muslims are in favor of punishing people who draw anti-Muslim cartoons. 1 in 10 Muslims from Indonesia fully embrace the concept of jihad. These surveys have been around for decades. They're being virtually ignored. The more recent news is also being ignored. I have a harrowing story to share with you. We'll be right back. This is Bob Siegel. As a Christian apologist, I hear scorning and ridicule all the time from Bible skeptics and unbelievers. Some churches will still respond to such people with love and understanding. Others do not.
You Christians are such morons. There's no proof that God exists, and only a pea brain would believe in miracles. Wake up! Step into the 21st century. Besides, Christianity is responsible for most of the world's problems.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Relax, my friends. That's not the kind of response you'll get from Skyline Church. We welcome you just as you are, with all your doubts, all your questions, and all your concerns. Your problems with religion are understandable, and I promise at Skyline you'll experience the love of Jesus Christ, not the revenge of a Sith Lord.
Skyline Church, Sunday morning services at 8:30 a.m. and 10:30 a.m.
last few weeks, we've been in a series about Israel, and we're talking about a very important, very related topic. You need to understand, my friends, the problem that they have in the Middle East with Israel's existence is not that there isn't a two-state solution, one for the Israelis, one for the Palestinians. The problem is that Israel exists at all, period, because it's not a Muslim nation. I'm trying to show you how Israel's struggle is becoming the struggle around the whole world. For example, when a woman falls in love and gets married, her story is often considered a blessing with a fairy tale type happily ever ending. Unfortunately, such dreams can become nightmares in Pakistan. On May of 2014, a pregnant woman named Farzana Parveen was stoned to death right outside a courthouse, courtesy of her very own father and other relatives. The reason? This was an honor killing. Oh, that explains it, an honor killing. Farzana dared to marry a man of her choosing instead of submitting to the tradition of a family-arranged marriage. After an engagement of several years, Parveen, 25, tied the knot with her lover and preferred husband, Mohammed Iqbal. And that was against her family's vehement protests. Parveen was deliberately killed by on her way to court, where she had planned to answer charges of abduction filed by her family on behalf of her husband. Parveen's father was arrested and charged with murder. Speaking for the police investigator, Rana Mohshid promised to find and arrest everyone else connected to what he called a heinous crime. Arranged marriages are common with conservative Pakistanis. Each year, literally hundreds of women meet with a fate similar to Farzana Parveen. The term used for justification is the same that Parveen's father used, honor killing. Although the stoning method is rare today, this impromptu execution did happen in broad daylight, in front of a crowd that merely watched. According to her lawyer, Parveen's father and brothers had been waiting for her outside the court building. They were joined by other members of the extended family, around 20 in all. When Farzana and her husband approached the main gate, shots were fired into the air as her enthusiastic relatives tried to pull her away from Iqbal. While trying to fight back, Parveen was barraged with bricks from a construction site close by, all according to a report from Iqbal and the police investigator. The police also reported that Parveen's father surrendered after the attack. He was not shy about admitting what happened. He said, "I killed my daughter, as she had insulted all of our family by marrying a man without our consent, and I have no regret over it." The Human Rights Commission of Pakistan reports approximately 869 women met their doom through honor killings in the year 2013. While we can be grateful that the Pakistan government did not condone the crime, take a look at what their government does condone. In November of 2010, the UK Telegraph and BBC News reported on a 45-year-old Christian woman and mother of five who had been condemned by a Pakistani court for blaspheming the Prophet Muhammad. Miss Bibi insists no such blasphemy took place. Her relatives appealed the ruling. At the time of this broadcast, the final outcome of her case is still unknown after all these years. Whatever she may have truly said or not said, keep in mind that for many Muslims, adherence to Christianity is itself blasphemy, since Christians do not view Muhammad as a prophet of God. How can they, when the Quran denies the deity of Jesus and salvation through Jesus, two non-negotiable theological pillars for any follower who takes biblical authority to heart? Exclusive claims in the name of Jesus are no more dogmatic than the Quran's insistence that Allah alone is God, or that heaven is forbidden to any who doubt Muhammad's revelations. Therefore, blasphemy is often in the eye of the beholder. Being a Christian need not translate into disrespect for other religions, merely disbelief in other religions. Then again, when a Christian is sentenced to death in the name of Islam, respectable faces, they just drop their jaws. They also remember that these days it does not take much to blaspheme Muhammad. When a Danish newspaper published a cartoon of Muhammad, riots and burnings broke out all over the world. When it was falsely reported that an American prison guard in Guantanamo Bay flushed a Quran down the toilet, Muslims committed murders in retaliation. But that's nothing. Some Muslims have threatened violence if an infidel so much as touches the Quran. Ironically, there did not seem to be much Muslim outrage when Jewish synagogues were burnt down immediately after Israel turned Gaza over to the Palestinians. Jordan has a reputation for being one of the more benign Muslim countries. Is the reputation deserved? Well, right now, a horrific law is being challenged in Jordan. While there is every hope of seeing the law repealed, one must question how such a practice could have survived all the way up to the year 2017. According to Independent News, a Royal Judiciary Committee recently recommended that Article 308 of Jordan's Penal Code, which shields rape, statutory rape, and kidnap perpetrators from prosecution if they marry their victims, be abolished by the king, who heads both Jordan's judiciary and parliament. People in positions of power strongly object to the idea of challenging anything at all about Islam. Even when challengers acknowledge peaceful Muslims, they are still denounced for saying anything negative about the Quran at all. Some are even working toward outlawing criticism of Islam. The Organization of the Islamic Conference has systematically worked to criminalize the quote-unquote defamation of Islam and to protect Islam from quote-unquote blasphemy. In yearly resolutions at the UN on combating defamation of religions, the OIC complains, Islam is frequently and wrongfully associated with human rights violations and terrorism. Professor, and I know I'm not reading these names right, and I don't care. Professor Ekelman Ishkalu, head of the OIC, said the issue of Islamophobia has been placed at the top of our priorities and preoccupations while conducting a large-scale, worldwide effort to confront it. Human rights violations and terrorism associated with Islam? Where, oh, where would anybody get an idea like that? Yes, clearly. To even suggest a thing is Islamophobia. Intolerant voices continue to lecture the rest of us about tolerance. With every outbreak of new violence, an obligatory disclaimer takes center stage, explaining how most Muslims are actually quite peaceful. This song and dance has had more performances than Cats. The sum of the logic more or less says, honestly, Islam really is a peaceful religion. We can see where it doesn't always look that way. No, it does not look that way when churches are burnt down in Egypt or Bibles are forbidden in Saudi Arabia or children in Palestinian schools are taught that Jews are devils. But don't assume alternate religions to Islam are the only targets. Homosexuals are executed in countries like Saudi Arabia, Iran, Mauritania, Sudan, Somalia, and Yemen. This is Bob Siegel. I've been on the radio for many years, but let me tell you about a voice I've learned to appreciate far more than any radio announcers, Fred Falduti of Realty Executives All Area. Now, why do I care so much about Fred's voice? Because not long ago, Fred's voice spoke the following words to me.
Bob, I have some good news for you. They accepted your offer.
That's right. Fred Falduti just sold my house. With words like those, who needs radio? Folks, I'm telling you, choosing the right realtor is no small task. Fred took a personal interest in my situation, treating me less like a customer and more like a member of the family. And Fred's been doing this since 1994. Realty Executives All Area has sold thousands of homes locally.
Our footprints are throughout San Diego County, and we are proud of our accomplishments of assisting home sellers and buyers like you. Over the years, we've managed hundreds of real estate transactions and have encountered just about every kind of challenging situation possible.
That's it, folks. That's the voice that will sell your home. Whether buying or selling, the man you want is Fred Falduti with Realty Executives All Area, 619-719-7717. That's 619-719-7717 or fredfalduti.com. We radio hosts love to talk, but let's face it, when have we ever sold your home? Fred Falduti will.
Is it really true that there will be peace in the Middle East if we just have a two-state solution? Or are some people instead challenging Israel's right to exist at all? Is it true that Jews have no historical claim to the Holy Land and stole that land from a people called the Palestinians? Bob Siegel's latest book challenges the historical revision of the Israeli-Palestinian situation and shows how Israel's struggle may soon be the struggle of the entire world. The Holocaust Against Israel by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Think that if we just had a two-state solution, there'd be peace in the Middle East. The problem that they have with Israel is that she's not a Muslim country. And Muslims don't just have problems with Jews. They have problems with homosexuals, as I was saying, executed in countries like Saudi Arabia, Iran, Mauritania, Sudan, Somalia, Yemen. And when those fun-loving Taliban ran Afghanistan, they went after homosexuals with special cruelty. Of course, this did not catch as much news attention as their inhumane treatment of women. One of the more creative punishments sliced off the top of a woman's thumb for having the audacity to wear nail polish. The religion of peace, hard at work. Look, there are many genuinely peaceful Muslims who either reinterpret the Quran or do not understand their own Quran. But a dedicated Muslim who truly comprehends the commands of his prophet is not allowed to be moderate. Indeed, he may perhaps claim to be moderate as a tactic. Some Muslims will renounce terrorism and in the same breath embrace Sharia law or retribution toward any who defame their prophet. Nevertheless, Muslims of all varieties are reaching out for God, I mentioned this last week, with a genuine hunger and thirst. Many years before 9/11, I had the opportunity to share the gospel with a nominal Muslim from Saudi Arabia. I met him at Cal State Stanislaus. He was there as an exchange student. Eager to learn more about the Bible and wanting to give his life to Jesus, he took Jesus' command to count the cost very seriously. I'll never forget the words of this conflicted young man. He said, "You need to understand, if I become a Christian and return home, and if it is discovered that I am a Christian, they will cut my head off." Literally, today this same situation remains in Saudi Arabia. The government of Saudi Arabia speaks out against terrorist organizations such as ISIS and Al-Qaeda all the time. They have collaborated with United States intelligence to go after terrorism, but it is also against the law in Saudi Arabia to be a Christian. While technically that law may be separate from any official terrorist connection, it still shows how seriously and literally the Saudi government takes the commands to enforce Islam. In any event, this visiting student did become a Christian, and he did return to Saudi Arabia. I do not know whatever became of my friend. I do know this. He was one of the bravest men I have ever known. But bravery is rather fleeting today in our modern world, even when the choice has nothing to do with abandoning Islam, but instead squarely facing its violence. The Jassers of the world who issue such challenges are few. So are the town criers outside of Islam. Most people who see, or at least begin to see, the truth remain silent or refuse to pay any attention to glaring observations for fear of being branded an Islamophobe. Cowardice is only one part of a dangerous 21st century recipe. Other ingredients include sincere but bumbling attempts on the part of certain educators, politicians, and media pundits to make excuses for a religion that they clearly have not taken the time to examine with any degree of thorough study. Instead, they assume that most religious people must be dedicated to peace, simply by nature of the fact that they are religious. Such circular reasoning mixed with unthinking sheep-like adherence to political correctness complete a very lethal cake batter. Should this seemingly tasty dessert actually find its way into the oven, not only Israel, but United States, Europe, and our entire world will be in a lot of trouble. It has already started happening. It could get much worse. True or false? The events of 9/11 have led Americans to the conclusion that Islamic terror is a threat to be taken seriously and a threat truly inspired by the religion of Islam. It has nothing to do with any actions of Israel or America. Answer, false. People would be well advised to understand
that for the most part, Israel's neighbors resent Israel because they resent a non-Muslim country in the Middle East. Americans once recognized this. So did many other countries of the world, but such a successful PR campaign has been ignited against Israel that today people are believing lies about borders and lies about solutions being possible only with separate states. For many of Israel's enemies, the only solution they are interested in is something akin to Hitler's final solution. They are interested in sharing the land in only one way, with dead Jews buried beneath the land and Palestinians living on top of the land. That's how they want to share the land. Nevertheless, Israel is continually cast in the role of a villain. Now, some of you might be thinking, but Bob, this can't be merely about Israel being a non-Muslim country. After all, there are many Palestinian Christians, and they too loathe Israel for the way in which they've been treated. Yes, you're right. Palestinian children grow up hating Israel because they are taught from childhood the lie that the Israelis stole their land. They are uninformed about the amount of money Israel has generously poured into the Palestinian community as part of the so-called peace process. Money generally usurped by corrupt Palestinian leaders who channel the funds toward terrorist supply and recruitment. And so Palestinian Christians do indeed hate Israel. But this does not mean they are faring much better under the Muslims than other Christians in Muslim countries. While the Palestinian Authority has certainly claimed that Palestinian Christians are treated with equality, contradictory messages have managed to surface. On October 13, 2000, a live broadcast from a mosque in Gaza featured Dr. Ahmad Abu Haliaba, who said, "Allah the Almighty has called upon us not to ally with the Jews or the Christians, not to like them, not to become their partners, not to support them, and not to sign agreements with them. It should be understood that no law in Palestine protects freedom of religion. Don't take my word for it. A statement from the PA Information Ministry should suffice. It says the Palestinian people are also governed by Sharia law with regard to issues pertaining to religious matters. According to Sharia law applicable throughout the Muslim world, any Muslim who converts or declares becoming an unbeliever is committing a major sin punishable by capital punishment. The Palestinian Authority cannot take a different position on the matter." Here's another candid statement. This is from Media Watch. "Out of fear for their safety, Christian spokesmen aren't happy to be identified by name when they complain about the Muslims' treatment of them. Off the record, they talk of harassment and terror tactics, mainly from the gangs of thugs who looted and plundered Christians and their property under the protection of Palestinian security personnel. Make no mistake, ladies and gentlemen, the goal of spreading Islam continues to fuel the fire between Israel and the Palestinians, even though a false narrative about Israel's aggression has been spun for the suckers. The Palestinians have no more love for America than Israel. Perhaps in the passage of time, our objective journalists have forgotten that Palestinians of all ages, from elderly women to middle school kids, were seen in the streets celebrating after 9/11. Supposedly, America's presence in the Middle East, along with her allegiance to Israel, was the true inspiration for 9/11. Similar talking points claim that our military response in Afghanistan and Iraq made things even worse. So did the punishing of terrorists and enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay. Well, we'll talk more about Israel and how Israel's struggle is becoming our struggle next week.
The Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.